From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It's seed shopping time, time to kick off my annual seed series on the show and website and introduce you and myself to plants both traditional and cutting edge worth searching out to try in this year's garden. Today's guest, who'll show off some of each of those for us, is the founder of the Culinary Breeding Network, a collaborative community of plant breeders, seed growers, farmers, produce buyers, and chefs, aiming together to improve quality in vegetables and grains by creating and identifying and promoting more desirable cultivars. We'll meet Lane Selman and her extra tasty recommendations in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Lane Selman is an assistant professor in the Department of Horticulture at Oregon State University and founder of the Culinary Breeding Network. She confesses to an obsession with a diversity of radicchio, among other weaknesses, and I'm so glad to welcome her here today. Hi, Lane.
Hi. How are you?
I guess there are crazier things one could be obsessed with, right?
Yes, of course.
Of course. So, Culinary Breeding Network, tell us about its sort of genesis, and I think in its creation story there were peppers involved.
Right.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
Sure, yeah. So I work for Oregon State University here in Oregon, and I work on a project called NOVIC, which is the Northern Organic Vegetable Improvement Collaborative.
Yes.
And that is a project that's led by Oregon State University, but also includes the Organic Seed Alliance that's up in Washington, but works nationally, University of Wisconsin at Madison, and Cornell University. So at each of those institutions, there are breeders that breed at least part-time specifically for organic farmers,
yes,
which have very different needs. A lot of the same needs of a lot of gardeners, I believe, and so what we have done in this project is taken a lot of the breeding lines that all of these different plant breeders are working on that are specific for organic systems and trial them on a lot of different farms all over the country to see how they perform on organic farms.
Mm-hmm.
And we compare them to varieties that we know are going to perform really well on farms. We also test out new varieties that come out. You know, you open up your seed catalog, like right now at this time of year, we open the seed catalogs, and as farmers, it's like, oh, wow, well, there's all these new varieties. Are they going to do well for me or not? I mean,
right.
Everyone's thinking that, right? So we trial all those. And this one year, we were trialing these sweet peppers, so kind of like a roasting pepper, the ones that Corona de Toro, they call them, that are pointed, that are really nice for have thick walls for roasting. And we were trying to find a variety that would perform really well here in Oregon, where we have, we have short season. We have also evenings that get really cool, where a lot of times on the East Coast, like, they stay a little bit warmer. So we never really know if varieties are going to perform really well. So we're looking for that. And so we knew exactly what the farmers wanted out of a variety, but we were finding that out. We were doing all this work on the farms. But then I had the question, like, well, what about what they taste like? Because
<Right.
laughs> if they grow great, but they don't taste great, then that really isn't that helpful.
Then we could have just gone to the supermarket and gotten a really nasty.
Exactly. So
yeah.
What do they really taste like? And, sometimes as researchers, we get stuck in this thing where we're like, okay, well, let's just bite into it and give it a 1 to 9 rating. But I didn't really want to do that because mostly I didn't trust myself. And I was like, I'm one person. And what do I know about what, you know, how great a pepper is going to taste or not? And also, to be honest, it's hard for me to be unbiased because I'm out there in the field and looking at all of these, and I really want to choose varieties that perform really well for farmers. So I wanted to remove myself from the equation.
Right.
And so I asked a lot of chefs that I knew. I work at a farmer's market in Portland, Oregon at that time also. And I asked a bunch of chefs to get together and taste them with me. And they tasted them. And they basically started identifying the different things that they liked about those peppers that went beyond just the flavor, but actually the shape and the size.
Right,
like
because
rounded
there were
shoulders practicalities
of structure that make something in the same way that a piece of meat or a cut of fish or whatever is or isn't appropriate for a particular recipe or you know, a method of cooking. Same with vegetables, right? It's like,
Yeah. And then you're thinking about waste, too, like having efficiency in the kitchen and all these things that are very important. And I thought, oh, my gosh, are the plant breeders that are actually creating these new varieties of tomatoes or peppers or of everything, do they know what this wealth of information that the chefs and other, you know, value added, you know, if someone's making a hot sauce or something, or just the end user, do they spend enough time interacting with them to understand what the needs are
right.
in these varieties?
So you wanted to plug these participants who were working around these same vegetables, but not together yet. You plugged them together and made Culinary Breeding Network?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
So we started, organizing these events to bring these individuals, all these different stakeholders in our food system together, which has extended into just the public because we all are, you know, stakeholders in the food system.
Yeah. So you have this interesting perspective because you're working with all these breeders, many of whom we gardener types don't necessarily hear about. We may see one of their varieties. We may not even know who bred it or developed it. But you're interacting with all of these people, as you say, all these stakeholders, and you have the chefs and produce managers and all these other produce buyers and farmers and seed growers and breeders and so forth. So you get to see and hear about a lot of things that are kind of coming down the pike or that are starting to trend even before we gardeners see them in a catalog maybe. So like from your Instagram, which is at Culinary Breeding Network, I know some of the crops that you especially love, and I mentioned the radicchio in the intro. So tell us about that one, for instance. And is that something that you all have ever talked about among this group, these stakeholders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I could go on forever, so you're going to have to cut me off.
I'll just say shush now,
you know,
Lane.
So I am a Sicilian, and I grew up, with a lot of food and a lot of Italian food. So this is something that has just been something that we consumed, but it is not a crop or a vegetable that is consumed that much in the United States.
Right.
But working with chefs, there is an appreciation for different flavors other than sweet. I mean, this is something that we see all the time with plant breeding, is the trend keeps going toward breeding sweeter and sweeter things. But there, you know, there are earthinesses and, you know, an earthiness and there are bitterness and all these things that actually should be appreciated, I feel like, in vegetables. So there's that kind of culture, food culture kind of side that I really like about radicchio. But additionally, it is something that is very important in the Pacific Northwest, as well as where you are in the Northeast, to be consuming for individuals, you know, the public to be consuming, because that's what we grow in these areas in the winter. We cannot grow lettuce.
Yes.
So what I see a lot of times, like in the farmers market setting, is like all of these people come out and support farmers in the height of the season when, of course, everything is so wonderful and tasty. Why would you go to the grocery store? And farmers markets in a lot of areas are very plentiful. So it's convenient. You can go there. But as soon as it starts here, you know, it starts raining and it's cold and it's not so nice to go to the farmers market, people go back to the grocery store and they're buying lettuce and cucumbers from places that are very far away.
Yeah.
So I really want people to eat things that are grown here all year round. So we have a campaign called Eat Winter Vegetables. There's a website, eatwintervegetables.com. Radicchio is part of that.
So with the radicchio, then, one of the flavors that you get from it is the bitter, not the sweet. You were just talking about sweet and vegetables being something that a lot of people breed for and so forth. And it's more cold tolerant, so it can grow at a time when, say, lettuce can't, even in our northern areas. And I would say from the pictures on your Instagram, even though it's the leaves of the radicchio, they look like flowers. They're so beautiful, and they're all these sort of lavender and mauve shades and mottled and just beautiful, beautiful. Do you grow it in your home garden?
Yes, I do, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it's very rewarding. It's exciting. It's kind of like, I think I've always loved growing garlic because you plant
yes.
it, and then it's like you don't see it, and then all of a sudden you have this wonderful thing that you pull out of the ground. Well, radicchio you grow, and you can harvest the leaves and eat the leaves, but it heads up, And it can get a lot of frost damage on the outside and get really slimy. And you think, oh, God, you know, I've lost it. It's done. And then you get out there and you start pulling off these slimy leaves and you get down to just this hidden jewel of a little head that is beautiful and perfect.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite varieties that you want to tell us about real quick?
Oh, sure. So one thing I did want to mention is one of the reasons also that it hasn't been grown a lot is that there hasn't been a lot of resources as far as seed.
Yes.
So Uprising Seeds does have, they have several, they love Radicchio.
Yes.
And they do have several. And this year, I think it's the first time that they have released the Isotina, and that is one that is a pink. And so people are really drawn to
it's
the
beautiful,
pink.
Yes.
Those are called. Yeah, Rosa del Veneto, and there's several varieties of those, but that's a really beautiful one.
Okay. And so you said Italy, and it seems like, again, I infer from Instagram and from your website, that things Italian, including this crazy arugula that isn't even exactly an arugula that I've seen you extol the virtues of. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Is this the wasabi arugula?
Yeah. I mean, I think arugula is being like an Italian thing, you know, the peppery taste and whatever, but this is a little bit different.
This is a little bit different. It could be used in a lot of different ways, I think. It is an arugula that tastes just like wasabi. So I would imagine it in, you know, Japanese, Asian type food, but it is pretty spectacular how much it tastes like wasabi. It can be really fun to play some tricks on people.
And I see that like Renee's and Johnny's and Territorial, a lot of people have it, but I also see that they put it in a different genus as opposed to in Eruca, E-R-U-C-A, where I would put Eruca. Mm-hmm. It's Diplotaxis. So I know they're both brassicas, but I don't know how close their relationship is. So I'm going to do a little more taxonomic homework on that because that was real interesting. Wasabi arugula.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some other things that you're excited about right now?
Well, I'm very excited all the time about things that are Italian, right? So I'm also very excited about fennel and borage. I think we talked once before about borage being something that people plant a lot of times for pollinators. I mean,
yes.
It can get pretty weedy in your garden, but it's got beautiful flowers. It attracts a lot of pollinators, and you can actually eat the leaves of it. Very nice cooked down because it doesn't have a very nice mouthfeel with the pricklies on it unless you cook it.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a lot of new things that are out from seed companies for sure that it's kind of interesting. I've noticed this trend in a lot more varieties that are coming from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like a lot of us are going back, like we've been talking about, like my roots are from Sicily, so I'm always thinking about like that type of cuisine and wanting to feel more connected to it. So, you know, Uprising, I told you, they have a lot of, they have things from all over the world, but they have quite a few new peppers. The Sugar Rush peach pepper is out. They have that one, and that's a really fantastic pepper. It's got a great flavor. It's a really unusual color, a peach color. Great flavor, like I said, and it does really well in shorter seasons. So,
mm-hmm.
like for us out here in the Pacific Northwest, I think it's all in the Northeast where you are. It would do really well. They also have a beet that they're very excited about, I know. That is called, I'm probably going to botch a lot of these names because they're all in different languages.
I know, right? It's confusing.
Cropatine beet, and that is originally some seed that Brian was looking for, and I helped him get from an Italian friend of ours from a French company. So that's kind of a cylindrical beet that he is very excited about. He loves the flavor of.
Want to spell it for me, just if you can?
Yes, Crapaudine.
Okay, good. You mentioned fennel, finocchio, yeah? And
yes.
It seems like there's different strengths. Do you
yes,
know what I mean?
Yes.
Is that true? Do I infer from what I'm reading, the catalog descriptions, that some are more licorice-y than others? Or?
Exactly. You know, we did, in that Novick project, trialing of varieties of fennel one year. And really noticed that. And then I also went back to Italy and visited some plant breeders, and they talked about that quite a bit, too, because in Italy, they really appreciate that very anisey, licorice flavor. So theirs are smaller, usually flatter, and have more intense flavor like that.
Okay.
Whereas a lot of those that they grow the seed for export that's going to be grown in the U.S. or in England. They're larger, rounder, and more watery, so a lot less flavor.
Yeah. You mentioned beets, and I think that I've seen this beet from Row 7, newish seed company. Have you seen this beet of theirs that's getting some
press? Yes, they have Badger Flame.
Yeah.
And that's a delicious beet. It's great cooked. It's great raw. And that is from Erwin Goldman, who is a beet breeder at the University of Wisconsin. He's a fantastic breeder. He really appreciates, again, that earthiness, right? So it's like with some really sweet beets, but then also to like be able to have this earthiness. But I believe that's a pretty sweet and quite beautiful beet that tastes fantastic raw, which is often not the case.
Right, Badger, and then Flame. The Flame sort of speaks to the beauty of it, the colors in it, yes?
Yes, exactly. It's kind of like a Kyoja, like that candy cane stripe,
yes.
But it's very prominent, like yellow and orange stripes. Super beautiful.
Anything good going on in chard? I love chard.
Ooh, that's a good. But, you know, I really enjoy the Beatola, which is that is like the Italian chard, and it's a pretty mild chard. It doesn't have the midrib that's colored. It's just green and white, and it's less Savoy. I'm trying to think of a good seed source for that. Maybe you know. I've actually bought this from seeds from Italy a lot of times, the
yes,
big packages
yes, yes, yes.
that you have enough for years.
I've
grown from them before. Really enjoy that.
It's funny that you say that because I love like Silverado and Ford Hook Giant and Glotcher Silber, the ones that have the white midrib and the
yes.
green leaf. I've always preferred those to the colorful, and the colorful ones are gorgeous, obviously.
Yes.
And the reason I thought of chard is because it's kind of a cousin to beet, and so we were just talking about beets, so it came into my head, but...
Yeah, it's really nice. It's mild, and it's really it's really nice in like a gratin or something like
yes,
that. But
yes,
you get away from as less of a beet flavor because of not having those pigments, I think.
Yeah. So recently, I saw that you, along with some collaborators, now not under the auspices of Culinary Breeding Network specifically, but other collaborators, you participated in kind of this paper about. Squash, winter squash, and, you know, everybody
yeah.
grows butternut and delicata and acorn, but this was about kabochas and buttercups. It was a little
mm-hmm.
different. Tell us about that, because those are two, I feel like, people who haven't grown them and haven't used them in the kitchen, they're just so different and special.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, you know, we got involved in that project at OSU. Alex Stone led that project, and a lot of the growers out here have a lot of problems with squash in storage. So even
yes.
though they might have really fantastic tasting butternuts and delicatas are more popular here than acorn, they don't last very long in storage. I mean, the delicata is a pepo, so it doesn't normally last very long anyway, but
right.
They rot. And then we really want people to be eating squash during the time of year that they should, winter squash. So, like, not having people in at, like, Thanksgiving, a lot of times people are like, oh, I've burned out on squash. And it's like, well, this is really just the beginning.
Yes.
And so looking at these other squash that grow well for farmers and gardeners and that store really well without having to be in this kind of optimal conditions where
yes.
you have, like, a warehouse that's at the specific, humidity.
I have no warehouse, Lane. I have no warehouse.
I know, right? So we call it shackability. Instead of storability, it's like, can it shack,
Can you shack up with the squash?
Handle, where we're actually going to be putting it, which is for
yeah.
storage, which is probably going to be a shack.
So
they taste really different, too, and I really think that they should be considered quite different from one another. And we have that project is called, these are very easy websites to remember because we had Eat Winter Vegetables,
mm-hmm.
but we also have Eat Winter Squash. So
okay.
if you go online there, you can find out all different types of winter squash, including the kabocha and the buttercup types, that store longer, which maybe when you're done with eating your, delicata because it's an early season squash,
yes.
moving on to the next one. And then some of them will, last, a year. But there's recipes online. It kind of puts them in categories of what's the most appropriate way to use it, like baking it into a dessert or using it raw. This is something we've really been working with chefs and like the public to get people to eat more winter squash, is a lot of them do really nicely if they're raw. You know, winter squash can take a long time to cook and people are busy and they don't want to deal with it. So just busting one open and using like a mandolin or just a vegetable peeler and, you know, putting it raw into a salad. Mm. We have a great salad that's with black futsu squash that we see a lot. A lot more here, like Whole Foods, grocery stores. It's kind of a newer squash for the public, with a treviso, which is a type of radicchio salad. Really fantastic.
Mm.
So that one is online, but a lot of information about different
good
types of squash.
So, and with all of these things that we've been talking about, I'll give, obviously, with the transcript of the show, the illustrated transcript, I'll give lots of links for people to learn more. So in our last just 2 or 3 minutes, you have these events, and you referred to this in the beginning. You have these variety showcases, and everybody kind of gets together and tastes and talks and swaps information and networks and whatever. And I think there's one coming up February 16th, for instance. Is that where you are in Portland? Or is it?
Exactly. It's in Portland, Oregon. It's going to be, probably about 40 tables of plant breeders and seed growers that that show off a lot of their breeding work, sometimes things that are not yet released, so you get to look at them and give your opinion to the plant breeder. The plant breeders match up with a chef who then makes something always really fantastic and usually pretty creative and interesting. They really like to, you know, blow it out of the water with these breeders because they're kind of experimental, you know, things that we don't know about yet, like they have really beautiful carrots and the beets and radicchio, and it's so many different things. We have grains, fruits, and vegetables there, about 40 different tables. Yeah, you can get tickets online. It's really fun.
And you sometimes have these in other places, too, don't you, these events?
We've done them. I've done them twice in Oahu and once in New York City.
Yes, I remember.
Yep, and they usually in the midst of the season. So they're usually in September when we've got a lot of different, you know, fresh produce is plentiful. So this has been a challenge, but we are trying to get people very excited about Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and radicchio and celeriac, and I think it's working. We had a Sagra, which is like a celebration event of winter vegetables, along with a Fill Your Pantry farmers market, and we had 30 farmers made $87,000.
Cool.
One
oh my
sale.
Goodness. Good for you.
And it's fantastic, right? And, you know, they're selling things that they're like, you know, people haven't really been excited about celeriac and rutabaga, but now people are. So hopefully it's making an impact.
I think that my neighbors, I have a seed company in my town, in my little rural New York State, Hudson Valley town, Turtle Tree Seed, a biodynamic seed company. And I think Leah Babich, who's in charge of it, I think she said that they're bringing a bean to the...
They are. They're bringing...
Aunt Ada's Italian.
Aunt Anna Ada's.
Yeah.
Aunt Ada's whole bean.
So Aunt Ada, so this Christmas, I had a new book come out last year, and this Christmas, with my local bookstore, lots of my readers ordered copies to give as gifts, signed copies, and I gave a packet and my recipe for vegetable soup that Aunt Ada must be in every vegetable soup. It changes your vegetable soup completely.
Oh.
So 75 or 80 people ordered a book, a signed book, and they each got a packet of Aunt Ada. So I'll be there in spirit.
Okay.
Aunt Ada's my girl.
I'll get you there in person sometime.
So thank you so much for taking the time, Lane. And like I said, we'll have lots and lots of links and more information with the transcript. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books and gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy seed shopping meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.